This is the 31st broadcast in the America Looks Abroad series, presented by the officers and staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. This nonpartisan organization, open to all who are interested in American foreign policy, offers accurate information on current international events. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. The Battle of France and Italy's entry into the war have swung the military balance strongly against the Allies. Mr. David H. Popper, research associate of the Foreign Policy Association, will discuss the Battle of France and the United States. Mr. Popper.
Good afternoon. This has been a black week for the democracy, the blackest perhaps in all their history. In the 12 days of the Battle of France, they have suffered the consequences of more than 20 years of mistaken policy. The Germans have beaten down the game French army. They have hammered and rushed their way into Paris. With relentless force, they have outflanked the citadels of the Maginot Line. At the decisive hour, Hitler has been aided by Italy's entrance into the struggle. While the British are hastily refurbishing their battered expeditionary force and trying to land fresh units in France, the French government has fled from Paris to Tours, from Tours to Bordeaux. Premier Reynaud has twice addressed desperate appeals for assistance to President Roosevelt. French political and military leaders are closeted in long sessions to canvass possibilities for the future. Rumors of an imminent French surrender are flying thick and fast. We are watching the crumbling of a country, an empire, a way of life. And, especially for those of us who know France and the French, it is a heart-rending spectacle. How have the Nazis succeeded in doing what we should have thought practically impossible 2 months ago? They have done it by refusing to fight this war on the Allies' terms. The British and French, you remember, made preparations for a long war, lasting at least 3 years. They were content to assume the defensive on the battlefield behind their fortified line, relying on the blockade to weaken Germany, so that its fighting power would wither away as its reserve materials were gradually consumed. Meanwhile, the Allies could slowly mobilize their own fighting strength. Hitler understood that he could not win this type of war. From the German point of view, the situation demanded that the armies and the fortresses that blocked German domination of Europe and German access to the seas must be smashed before the blockade could be made effective. To smash them, it was necessary to concentrate at the crucial point a massed striking force, the like of which the world has never seen. It was necessary to win the initial advantage, and, once having won it, never to give the enemy time to catch his breath or to reform his forces. Time was of the essence. Time, efficiency, and energy, single-minded concentration on the purpose to be achieved. The Allies had prepared for the kind of fighting they learned 25 years ago. But the new fashions in this field are made in Berlin. Hitler, it is said, has become a deep student of German history. He remembers first that the German victories of the last century have been won in short wars. The triumph over Denmark in 1864, the 7-week campaign against Austria in 1866, the Franco-Prussian War, really won at Sedan in 1870. Second, the Führer must see that Germany's fatal error in 1914 was to engage in simultaneous warfare on two fronts, against the Allies and Russia. Hence the rules of German success are clear. Mobilize everything for one quick and supreme gamble, and in politics and in war, isolate your opponent before striking at him. To this the Germans have added another maxim, born of the bitter stalemate on the Western Front in World War I. Avoid stability at all costs. Find the enemy's weak spot, pour your forces through the gap, circle his rear, and cut his communications. The perfect coordination of air and mechanized forces has made this strategy work, and the Allies do not seem to have been able to develop methods to stop it. Note the superb technical success of the Nazi operations in the West. The Norwegian campaign, started just over 2 months ago, secured Germany's northern flank and gave the Reich a vantage point from which to break the blockade and harass the British coast. The second step, from May 10th to 14th, was the carefully planned conquest of the Netherlands, completed before any Allied countermeasures could be fully organized. The third phase, following immediately thereafter, was the mysterious penetration of the supposedly impassable Ardennes forest in southeast Belgium by German mechanized forces, and their equally mysterious breakthrough against the inadequate French troops at Sedan on the Meuse. Someday we shall learn just how this happened, for it is the key to all that has followed. The onrushing Germans cut the Allied forces in two, crushed the Belgians, forced the British to abandon their materiel and retreat across the Channel, and then turn against the remainder of the French armies, largely bereft of British aid, and strove to shatter their resistance. If this last blow can be carried through, Britain, the arch-enemy, will confront the Reich weakened and alone. What will follow this cataclysmic tragedy rests in the realm of conjecture. One thing is certain. With the vital centers of the great British and French empires in jeopardy, the outlying territories are no longer sources of strength, but, because they require dispersed forces to defend, sources of weakness. That is crystal clear to Mussolini. The Duce wants to wrest control of Gibraltar and Suez, those strong points of empire, from Allied hands in order to give Italy unrestricted access to the open sea, and thus make possible the expansion of an Italian-African empire. Like Germany on the continent, Italy enjoys the great advantage of a central position, of interior lines, in the new struggle for the Mediterranean. The fascists can strike outward from the center. The Allies have had to spread their forces at numerous points along the 3,000-mile route from Gibraltar to Aden at the southern end of the Red Sea. Normally, British and French naval and air forces would be able to converge with crushing effect on Italian cities and bases. But today, a high proportion of Anglo-French strength must have been called home, and what remains in the Mediterranean is cut off from reinforcements and new supplies. The world knows that Mussolini has the resources for only a short war. He hopes to win a short and easy war now, under conditions that may never recur, so that Italy will never again be shut off from the materials of the outside world. And at least one other nation, Turkey, believes that the chances for success in this endeavor are so good that it has decided not to enter the war on the Allied side just now, despite its mutual assistance pacts with Britain and France. In diplomacy and in war, nothing succeeds like success. Nothing less than the future of the British and French empires, therefore, is at stake in the Battle of France. These empires are not just aggregates of territory under central domination. Each embodies, in its own way, principles of government and principles of individual life which seem foredoomed to vanish in Europe if the fascist drive is successful. And if democratic ideals and democratic freedom are driven from Europe, they are endangered here. Not that we need fear an immediate invasion from across the Atlantic. Assuming that could be done at all, it would take long preparation and superhuman effort. But several straws in the wind show just where the danger lies. Note, the Uruguayan discovery of the activities of its German minority. Note also the President of Brazil's speech last Tuesday with its frankly fascist tone, and the haste of our Congress to pass a resolution putting this country on record against transfer of European colonies in this hemisphere to other non-American states. And finally, the concern over so-called fifth column activity in this country. The plain fact is that millions of Americans feel that a Nazi victory in Europe would destroy the stability of American life. That is why, in answer to Premier Reynaud's appeal, President Roosevelt has assured the French that the United States will redouble its efforts to send airplanes, artillery, and munitions to the Allies, as long as they continue to resist. But the clouds of airplanes for which Monsieur Reynaud asked cannot be forthcoming. There should be no illusion about our ability to turn the tide in Europe this summer. That cannot be done, because the United States, as surprised as the Allies by what has happened in recent weeks, is caught at this crucial moment without armaments on the scale necessary for use on European battlefields. We are sending something like 340 of our Army and Navy planes, in addition to those our manufacturers have built for the Allies, to Britain and to France. But these are not sufficient. We are preparing to dig deeply into our old World War stocks of Army reserves. According to unofficial reports, we are sending an estimated 600,000 Enfield rifles, between 500 and 800 field guns, apparently 75-millimeter field artillery, and a considerable number of old model trench mortars, machine guns, and similar equipment, together with ammunition. But these, too, are not sufficient, and we have too few of the newer weapons of warfare to make large enough contributions. Under its latest procurement program, adopted last spring, the United States Army had on hand, on the 1st of May, 1940, 448 3-inch anti-aircraft guns, and none of the newer 90mm model. It had 15 37mm rapid-fire anti-aircraft weapons, 38,000 semi-automatic rifles, 10 light and 18 medium tanks, and no heavy tanks. This is not an all-inclusive list. The United States has hundreds of tanks of earlier models and much other equipment. But plans were not made to acquire large stocks of the most modern and most necessary items until the spring of 1939, when our current expansion program was adopted. That program is not scheduled for completion until the middle of 1941. Perhaps American military production can be speeded up, but everyone familiar with the complicated processes of arms manufacture knows that it takes many months to get results under the very best of circumstances. So we are almost powerless to meet the immediate needs of the Allies. American military commitments or a declaration of war, which, as President Roosevelt said, can only be made by Congress, might have a moral effect on the situation, but scarcely a material effect. This crisis is measured in hours, our assistance in months. In 1917-1918, with many more factors in our favor, one whole year elapsed after our declaration of war, before troops were being sent to France in appreciable numbers, over 100,000 per month. And, politically speaking, this country does not seem prepared today to send men overseas. The only hope for Allied survival, therefore, is for them to gain time, somehow, until their material resources, and ours, can be brought to bear in the field or on the sea. With only slight help from the United States, they must establish and hold a line somewhere until this fall or winter, when military operations will slow down and American supplies will begin to pour out in greater volume. Then, if it were still a non-belligerent, the United States might repeal the Johnson Act and the cash-and-carry provisions of the Neutrality Act, lending or giving money to the Allies and using its own ships to transport war supplies to them. It might send some reconditioned World War destroyers to bolster the Allied fleet. Volunteers might cross the ocean to aid the Allied air and land forces. Most important of all, newly manufactured special steels, machine tools, scientific instruments, aircraft, tanks, and other munitions would stream across the seas. Thus, the crucial question is whether Britain and France can organize a center of resistance which will hold out for the next 6 months against all attacks. Given the speed and ferocity of the German advance of the last 3 days, it seems unlikely that such a base can be held in France, although the Allies, abandoning the Maginot Line, may attempt to stand along the River Loire from the ocean to the Swiss border. This would mean that they were attempting to struggle along under tremendous odds, having abandoned to the invaders 75% of France's coal resources, the whole iron and steel industry of Lorraine, the tank and plane factories around Paris, the vast oil depots of the Northwest, and all ports offering easy transportation facilities to Britain. So the outlook for resistance in France is dark. A base might possibly be held in England, although the prospect for feeding and supplying that country when Germany controls the whole continental coast and the shipbuilding or submarine building facilities of Denmark, Holland, Belgium, and France are none too bright. He would be a rash prophet who would predict the outcome of current events with any confidence. We may be sure of only one thing, that out of the chaos of this battle, a new world is emerging in which this generation will have to live. It will profoundly affect the lives and fortunes of us all.
Mr. David H. Popper, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association, was today's speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. If you would like a free copy of this talk, send your request to the Foreign Policy Association, 8 West 40th Street, New York City. We invite you to tune in next Sunday to hear another speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.